I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau,
Christopher, Michael,
Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Saadad 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the show, we have a very special guest, Professor Shai Hazkani, author of the fascinating book, Dear Palestine, A Social History of the 1948 War. He's also the co-creator of the equally fascinating documentary, The Soldier's Opinion. And boy, does he provide a fresh and illuminating perspective on the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. You could call it a parallax view on the 1948 Arab-Israeli War that looks at the opinions of non-elites who were in some way a part of the 1948 War. This is going to be just a fascinating conversation if you have any interest in Israel-Palestine whatsoever, as we delve into such topics as propaganda and war mythologies, Professor Hazkani's battles with the Israeli Supreme Court over documents that are being held in Israeli archives, comparing and contrasting his work to that of the Israeli New Historians. There is some overlap, but there's also some differences, and much, much more. Also, if you're wondering, yes, we will tie Professor Hazkani's work on the history of the 1948 war into a discussion of what is currently happening today with both the Gaza War and settler violence in the West Bank. All that and more in the conversation to follow with Professor Shai Hazkani, author of Dear Palestine, A Social History of the 1948 War. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I'm really, really, really happy to have on the show. He's made some time to speak with me and my audience, Professor Shai Hazkani is an assistant professor of history and Jewish studies at the University of Maryland, and he's the author of a book that I think has proven very invaluable. It was recently, very, very recently recommended to me, entitled Dear Palestine, A Social History of the 1948 War. How are you doing? And I know that's a crazy question to ask given these rather, it feels almost apocalyptic times. It's very worrisome, this moment that we're in.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. I'm deeply depressed and saddened by this moment that I never thought I'll see in my lifetime. But I'm holding on to any little hope for something a slightly less violent future that hopefully will emerge in some way.
I want to get into some of the specifics of your book, but before we do that, how important do you think it is for people to understand the 1948 war when it comes to also understanding the events we see transpiring right now?
I think it's essential. I really do, because that's the sense that people sometimes have that violence suddenly erupted on October 7th, or sometimes they go a little bit before that in 2021 or in 1982. That is a false notion, right? This story of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, if you will, or if you want to call it something else, the struggle over Israel-Palestine dates back a very long time, right, to the late 19th century, really. But 1948 is really such a pivotal moment, right? On the one hand, the creation of the State of Israel, and on the other hand, the almost complete erasure of Arab Palestine, right? And so that's a really, really important moment to grapple with and understand when we are looking at the conflict, right? What's the Gaza Strip? How was it created, right? It is a creation of the 1948, right? And most of its residents and their descendants are refugees from that major event, the 48 war, and that what I termed the erasure of Arab Palestine.
When it comes to, since you've taught classes on the conflict, something that I often get from friends and family is that they almost feel overwhelmed by the history at times, and they don't know how to tackle it. So what do you think the most important points are in understanding the origins of the Israel-Palestine conflict?
That's a tough question. Oftentimes I hear people sort of repeating that mantra that it's complicated. And it's true and it's untrue, right? Life is complicated. Doing your taxes on April 15, that's also complicated. But it doesn't mean that, when it's used to shut down the conversation about Israel-Palestine, that's when we need to be worried, right? It's complicated, but it's if someone takes a little bit of time, not too much, I think they can grapple with this, right? Grapple with the story, how it evolved, right? And it's a story that includes, on one hand, persecution of Jews in the context of the Pale of Settlement in Eastern Europe in late 19th century, but also a settler colonial movement, something that we're very, very obviously familiar with in the context of the 19th and 20th century, in which immigration of people for all sorts of reasons, some of them justified, certainly in their view, right, fleeing persecution, but coming to another place that it has that has indigenous population, and on a gradual process removing that population, displacing them, etc. But to say that is also not enough, right? Because there is not a direct line, right, leading from 48 to the present. Certainly it is on a trajectory, and we can talk more about that trajectory, but along the way there were more than one opportunity to change course, right? The fact that the State of Israel is established by a movement that we should certainly acknowledge the fact that has its roots in settler colonial movements around Europe at the time does not mean that it leads all the way to October 7 in a certain sort of linear way. There were many opportunities along the way to change course, to sort of choose a less violent reality, a less violent future, and some form of peace and justice. And those courses along the way were not sadly chosen.
There's a lot to unpack in everything you just said, but the first thing I wanted to touch on was you mentioned the settler colonial paradigm and using that paradigm to understand all of this. I've seen since October 7th,
people saying, oh, we shouldn't use the settler colonial paradigm, because I think there has been certain voices after October 7th that have said some things that I disagree with, like this idea that, oh, well, everyone in Israel is a settler, so any action, even against civilians, is justified. I don't agree with that, but there's also people using the fact that that has been said to say that settler colonialism isn't the proper paradigm for this. And I think that's also a mistake. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. Look, there are scholarly ways and there are sort of activist political ways in which this term is used. You mentioned one of those, a morally corrupt one. I'm not ascribing it to you, of course, but right, this idea that, you know, the fact that the Israeli state and the Zionist movement also, among other paradigms that are relevant for its analysis, one of those is settler colonialism, and certainly Zionism is also a settler colonial movement, that sort of justifies or something crazy like that, the attacks on, you know, civilians in October 7, right? But of course, that's a morally correct one, in the sense that, you know, humanitarian law clearly distinguishes between civilians and our combatants, even in attacks that we would refer to or would also consider as anti-colonial ones. And, you know, I'm here at the University of Maryland, right? That this university has been built on, among other, the land of the Piscataway tribe, right? And, you know, we acknowledge it in some aspects, not enough in the context of the university, but no one would think that some attack of some sort on the premises of the universities or elsewhere around it could be, quote unquote, justified in the name of armed resistance against settler colonialism, although we obviously live in a very entrenched settler colonial context, not, of course, only the United States, Canada, Australia, right? Much of that world. Now, the question, of course, goes back to your, the issue really goes back to your earlier question of whether or not these places have changed course. And I don't want to talk much about the US because that's not my specialty. And, you know, the North American context certainly is not. But we see elsewhere, right, in the Canadian context, attempt to grapple with, you know, the origin, the whatever ancestral sin, if you'd like, of the creation of these places in the context of European hegemony, settler colonialism, racism, etc. Sadly, we have not seen, or almost have not seen, these attempts in the context of Palestine, Israel, you know, certainly not in recent history.
In terms of your book, Dear Palestine, A Social History of the 1948 War, I'm really interested to know how this project came about, because you have an interesting background yourself. I think you worked in media in Israel, and then you became a historian. So what has your trajectory been, and how did this specific project come about, and how does it differ from other histories of the 48 War?
So yes, I have quote unquote interesting past as a journalist, and it's interesting, you know, in the field of history, or at least the way I was sort of trained, sometimes admitting your sort of journalistic credentials were not something necessarily that was encouraged, under the sense that people would then say, oh, you're not really a historian, you're a journalist. And only after my book had come out and had received relatively good critical acclaim that I sort of came to embrace and more openly speak about that major part in my life for about for over 7 years. I was a radio and then a TV correspondent covering the occupied Palestinian territories and then the Israeli military. So that was sort of my first career. And obviously, I've done that at a very young age, and that really shaped who I was, right? I was growing up in Israel and was covering much of the second Palestinian uprising that started in the early 2000s, you know, been to many dozens of scenes of suicide attacks and the reoccupation of the West Bank in 2002 and several rounds of wars in Gaza and in Lebanon and elsewhere. And, you know, people, the kind of the conventional wisdom that people sometimes have is that, well, if you're on the ground, You really sort of know how things are. You have a really in-depth understanding of the situation. And it's true perhaps to a degree, but certainly by the time by the sort of late years of working as a journalist, I started having more and more doubts about the kind of, if you want to call it a service or whatever, that I was providing listeners and viewers. And I think that it was obviously a very gradual process. And by the end of my time as a journalist, I really felt that I was doing some sort of a malpractice, if you'd like, and that I really have to get much more in-depth expertise in this region. In the language, right? In the Arabic language, in the history of the Middle East, et cetera, to really tell a story to listeners and viewers that I can stand behind, that has a context, that because, you know, if you are covering the scene of a suicide bombing attack, you know, with the, you know, really traumatic sites and et cetera, and you have only that narrow view, then that's your whole life and your whole world. And you know, then from that angle, everything can be justified, right? Massive carnage and retaliation and revenge, et cetera, et cetera. But if you, quote unquote, step back, then you learn and you look at some of the history of that place and some of the larger context, then the story gets messier, more complicated. And that's the kind of sense that I started having toward the end of that first decade of the 21st century. And there were some major events that influenced me, a war on Lebanon in 2006, where I was embedded in Lebanon, and the rise of Hamas to power in Gaza after it won the elections, but eventually taking over in a sort of a overthrowing other structures and regimes that were in place in Gaza. By that time, I was already kind of thinking of maybe looking towards academia, and had these plans of coming over to the US to do my master's in Arab studies at Georgetown University. That's where I did my graduate degree. I was very fortunate to have been accepted, and had a very interesting time there. I was the first sort of Israeli Jewish person to enroll in that program, and you know, for the first time, met literally people from everywhere around the Arab world, and it was a very, a very profound and very important experience for me. I still had a year to spend on Israeli TV before the school started in the U.S., and by that point, I was very eager to tell stories on Israeli television that are have a more profound academic side to them on the one hand, but could also be related to larger audiences in television. That's not an easy task to accomplish. At some point, I was at the Israel Defense Forces archives. It's sort of a military compound at the time. You can really not even bring your cell phone inside, etc. And I was researching. Basically, there was this I think it was in 19. In 2007 or 2008, it was just a milestone of the first arms deal where Israel had sold weapons to West Germany. That was in the middle of the 50s, in 1955 or so. And there was an interesting moment because, you know, Israel was selling these Uzi rifles to West Germany, you know, a decade after the extermination of Jews in the Holocaust. And that created a lot of anger within the Israeli society, demonstrations, and, you know, even the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, was breached. And I was sitting in the IDF archives looking through documents from that arms sales to Germany, when suddenly this really odd document surfaced. One army bureaucrat is writing to another, perhaps some high-ranking officer, you know, by the way, The kind of anger and resistance and activism in the Israeli society is also reflected within the armed forces. And we know that because, as you know, this army bureaucrat is telling his commander, we're secretly reading and intercepting the soldiers' letters, right? And if you want to read what they've been thinking about this arms deal, I refer you to this The Soldier's Opinion, that's how the publication was called, that includes their letters. And I was like, huh, I have never heard this. And I just saw a reference to this, fortunately, as a correspondent covering the Israeli armed forces and the intelligence apparatus in Israel. It was a quick check. And I asked some of the sources that I had at the time, and they revealed to me that from 1948 all the way to 1998, basically, Israel had this postal censorship apparatus that secretly intercepted and copied letters of soldiers, not to spy on individual, although that was done as well, but rather to get the state of mind of those populations more broadly. And so I requested to see that document. It actually took a long time to get that. And I've had like this decade-long legal struggle against Israel's classification policies.
But I was going to say, you actually went to the Israeli Supreme Court with Shin Bet, right?
Right. Yeah, I went to the Supreme Court to get the Shin Bet archives open. And here was a spoiler, that did not work out. The court said that I'm correct in principle, but that the Shin Bet has, you know, these secrets that it cannot reveal to the public, even about its activity in as early as the 50s. I was able to get some of those soldiers' opinion reports. And I remember sitting in the archives in 2007 or early 2008, looking through these letters, and each of that report, these reports were written by the intelligence apparatus and then sent to the Israeli leadership, David Ben-Gurion and others. And I remember looking through that report, literally, I remember that moment sitting in the archives, at the archives, and it was just such a important aha moment for me, because the letters really told a story that I was not really familiar with, really told, you want to call it a subversive story or just a different narrative about the 1948 war, but not only, also about Mizrahi Ashkenazi relations in Israel, about the Palestinian refugee problem, and about many other episodes in Israeli history. And, you know, one of the first letter I came across, I actually end the book with, it's this letter by this Israeli soldier who in the late 1950s is sent to blow up a Palestinian village. As I'm sure you know, in the 1948 war, 500 or so Palestinian villages were depopulated, 750,000.
So this is known as the Nakba in Palestinian.
The Nakba. Yeah. And then over a decade and a half after the war, those villages were systematically destroyed. And so this is a soldier that is likely sent to blow up or something like that, one of these depopulated villages. And can I read you this this letter that we have? So this is what he writes, and it's one of the first letters that I came across at the archives. He says, "The surroundings here are full of ruined Arab villages. We were always taught that we won over the Arabs because we love the land more and that it's ours. But when I walk around and see all these mountains covered with terraces, I can see it's a lie. Hundreds of years of work were put into every site here. It's unbelievable. There aren't even 50 meters without a terrace, and there's a lot of carob trees. It's hard to grasp this change. People used to live in these ruins. Maybe they loved and hated like we do, and now who knows where they are." And so it's such an important, interesting letter, because the soldier really reflects on some of the indoctrination and socialization that he had gone through, bringing him up to that moment, but is also able to contest some of the reality that he sees on the ground.
Yeah, it brings to mind in the introduction of your book, you talk about an Iraqi Jewish soldier, Abdullah Dawood, who was interviewed by journalists, I think in the 90s, if I recall right from the book.
And, you know, it's interesting when you're telling his story a bit and how the journalist reacted to him. I think what this book really gets at is that this dichotomy of, oh, 48 was, you know, an Arab versus Jews war. You're saying that there's a lot to undermine that, especially when you look at it from the perspective of the soldiers or the non-elites on the ground versus, you know, maybe the elites and the institutions on both the Arab and the Israeli side that have their own sort of agendas that may differ from the various people on the ground. Can you talk about that elite versus non-elite dynamic?
Absolutely. And you were referring to the opening anecdote. We should add that this is a Jewish Iraqi who fights for the Arab side, right, in 1948, which makes it, of course, you know, for 99.9% of those who would come across this story is almost, you know, like a man bites dog kind of story. And I thought it was an interesting story to open with, not because it was very, very common. You certainly has a few dozen of these people, but because
this is a soldier that's fighting for the Arab forces that is, so he's shooting on other, on Jewish. Yeah,
absolutely. And so he participates in this landmark battle called the Mishma HaEmek battle in the Jizreel Valley, or the Maj ibn Amer, as it's called. And so the journalist, right, interviewing him in the 90s, just as the U.S. is starting its own occupation or invasion of Iraq, is just shocked and baffled and cannot understand how that's possible. But what I try to show in this book, and that really goes back to this question of elite versus non-elites, is that those stories, they look very differently from the ground, right? From the ground up or from below, as we call it in history. And so in that sense, I hope that's the contribution that the book makes, right? I'm not as interested in, quote unquote, what really happened. Not in the sense that I deny that we have a good sense of how 1904 transpired. But I'm interested rather in what not just Israeli soldiers, but also Palestinians and Arab volunteers from around the world, what sense they made of reality, what it meant for them. Did they buy into the kind of indoctrination and socialization that the elites were putting them through at the time, right? Because, you know, they were told who is the enemy, what to do to that enemy. Or did they resist it? Did they accept it? And, you know, another spoiler, you know, certainly a large number accept it. But there's also some really fascinating dissent, right? So I showed that 70% of these Moroccan Jewish volunteers who come to Israel to fight in the 48 war want to leave Israel and go back to Morocco. That statistic secretly collected by this intelligence apparatus. Why do they want to return and are in fact sometimes really disenchanted with the kind of Zionism that is exhibited by European Jews? They want to return because of the racism against them. And that racism makes them even sort of rethink those historical connections to the Arabs and Muslims of Morocco and even of Palestine itself. I look at these American Jews, right? Many argue that in the apocalyptic days that we are in the younger generation of American Jews, there's a rethinking of their relationship to Israel and Zionism. Well, I show that that kind of reevaluation and even serious disenchantment already takes place in 1948. So the book follows these group called Mahal Volunteers, several thousands of them, and the vast majority came from the U.S. And, you know, in the decades since 1948, their stories have often been celebrated in the American context. There's even a documentary film by Steven Spielberg's daughter that was made in the honor of these volunteers. Well, guess what? In these letters of them that were secretly intercepted, we see that some of them really had a very hard time with what they saw in 48, primarily the adoption of militarism and the use of force as a founding principle. And I look at one particular letter in the fifth chapter of this American volunteer who says, you know, Basically, Israel had turned into what he terms a golem, right? Abandoning its religion for a revolver. What is this idea of a golem? The golem is this mythical creature that's created by this very famous rabbi of Prague in the Middle Ages. It's sort of a Frankenstein-like figure that, he hears that worshippers nearby were going to attack Jews in Prague, and he erects this mythical, magical creature. He then protects those Jews, but then
But
starts
then it
robbing
goes out of
banks.
control, right?
Yeah,
And yeah.
right. Exactly. In killing innocent or injuring innocent bystanders. And so this writer, whose letter was intercepted and sent to the Ben Gurions of the time, saying, "Yeah, that's what we created here, American Jews. The Golem is the state of Israel, and we need to basically, rein it in, or disentangle with it, or something like that."
Can you talk about, the Arabs and Palestinians on the ground versus the institutions like the ALA, and maybe the way that identity was contested between the two different, groups of people?
Yeah, so the book largely looks at the Israel Defense Force, the IDF, and the Haganah on the one hand, and on the other hand, something known as the Arab Liberation Army, Arabic Jesh al-Inqadh al-Arabi, which was this volunteer army that was created by the Arab League. The Arab League in itself is an entirely new institution from 1945, and one of the serious concrete projects, the first ones that it has, is the establishment of this Arab Liberation Army. Now, why it's established, that gets a little tricky. On the one hand, certainly in a desire to abrogate the partition of Palestine, right? The UN had decreed that Palestine will be divided into an Arab and Jewish state. They want to do off with that, and they have all this grandiose propaganda about eliminating Zionism. But when you dig a little deeper, you see that the main patron of the ALA, his name was Shukri al-Kawatli. He's the Syrian president, and he actually has a much more. He basically wants to defeat his number one nemesis, the king of Transjordan, King Abdullah, who has King Abdullah is in the Hashemite family, have been for decades secretly negotiating with the Zionists and later with Israel, trying to see whether they could come to an agreement to divide the area of the Levant between them. And King Abdullah at this point has all these intentions of taking over the Arab parts of Palestine. Shukri al-Kawatli is very concerned that the next step will be taking over his Syria. And so one of the reasons he establishes the ALA is to prevent that. And so you have all these intrigues between those Arab leaders. Another thing to remember is that a lot of these countries, right, are still semi-colonial in the sense they're formally independent at this point, but the British and the French are pulling most of the strings to the degree that the Transjordanian army, the Arab Legion, is commanded by a British officer, and all the top rank officers are British, right? And so it's a very complicated case in which so many people are pulling the strings, right? The Arab leaders themselves, the European forces, etc. And so you have this decision to create the ALA, but separately from that, you have this massive, really unprecedented movement for mobilization and voluntarism around the Arab and Islamic world, right? So many, many, many tens of thousands of people in places that you would not imagine, surely in Syria, Lebanon, in Iraq, and Transjordan, etc., but also in Saudi and in Yemen and in Yugoslavia, etc. They come forward to register their name. They're saying, "We're willing to go fight in Palestine." Now, of these, only 5,000 actually make it to Palestine to fight, and that has more to do with the kind of pressures exerted by the European powers and by Arab leaders themselves. So they want to help Palestinians, but they also want to be careful and not get in the crosshair of anything more serious. And they also know from their own excellent intelligence that they're not a rival in any way, shape, or form to the Zionist armed forces. So we have these reports from before the ALA is dispatched to Palestine of the military committee of the Arab League, and they're saying very honestly, yeah, this is the there's no no comparing here, right? The Zionist forces have been trained by the British for many decades. Many of the commanding officers are veterans of the World War II. This is nothing in compared to what we can produce and what we have there. This force is sent to Palestine, and there starts, you know, they for the first for the months of March and April, it seems for a second that they will be able to put up a serious fight. But very, very quickly, the shortcomings of this army, lack of training, lack of food, not paying the even the stipends and small salaries to these volunteers, those became very apparent. By, I think, the second week of April, it is beyond doubt that the Israel Defense Force, some of the Defense Forces, the Haganah, is overwhelmingly stronger. And at this point, it's those volunteers individually, and we know that from their letters, that are trying to signal to Palestinians, we didn't make this army. We're here for you, and trying to ally with them in these individualistic ways.
For listeners that may be asking this question, I think there are listeners that are going to hear this and say, well, why is it so important that we necessarily look beyond just the nationalist binary of Arab and Jew when it as like analytical categories when it comes to this war? Why do you, what would you say to those listeners? Why is it important that, you know, we look at this social history that you're talking about beyond that nationalist binary?
Okay, so that's almost a more philosophical question. I'm happy to try and tackle it, but you know, let me come back to why I've written this project, and I've later co-created a film based on this for general audiences. It's called
The Soldier's Opinion, right?
Yeah, and you know, I have to be honest and say that my thinking of changed somewhat after October 7th. We can talk more about that. But initially, I thought that this is a story worth telling, because otherwise you just have the David Ben-Gurions and Amin al-Husseinis, the muftis, right, tell their story, and some other army generals and diplomats, and then, you know, historians that are using their words and memoirs and documents as scaffoldings for their narratives. But I thought that the stories are worth telling, especially because, you know, one of the claims that I make is that these category of Arab and Jews, it's not that they didn't exist before 48, but they were solidified from, let's say, 49 and into the 50s. Being Arab is, you know, means, you know, one or two or three things. Being Jewish or Israeli means one or two. And I want to show that, you know, up to the war, and I would say even to a degree after that, it was much more in flux, right? The story is much, 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 much more complicated, right? You have these Arab Jews coming. You have these, you know, volunteers and Palestinians from all over the world that have very different thinking about, you know, who these Jews are, why we need to fight them. These are often in major opposition or at least different than the kind of ideologies and grand narratives that, you know, they would have us believe. Now, what the importance of that for the current moment? I think that, you know, once you take into consideration that those sort of narratives are often sort of manufactured, they're a thing of the recent history from 1948 till today, 75, 76 years. And if you're trying to think of a future that is not as, you know, such a bloodbath of the kind of that we see today, I think that resurrecting those hybrid identities or whatever you want to call them, right? Those stories of American Jews who are saying, yeah, you know, those Holocaust survivors, they need a refuge, right? But that refuge cannot mean that, you know, an abandonment of all that we ever believed was a Jewish religion for this, what he calls this person, a revolver, right? So that those hybrid identities, the resurrection of which I hope, as people read that, can give – some hope for a better future and for, some opportunities that the future may have in store for those interested, in the place itself, right? That's where it's not about the cause. I care about the place. I have, so many friends and families in Israel, in Gaza, all these places. And so that's the kind of message that I hope people leave after they read the book.
So you said your thinking may have changed in some ways after October 7th. Can you elaborate on that?
Just became, increasingly pessimistic. There was this, people are often bickering and angry about the comparison between Israel, Palestine, and the apartheid regime in South Africa. I think that is another very important paradigm that's very accurately captures some of the reality on the ground. There is something about the apartheid paradigm or narrative, whatever you want to call that was also somewhat hopeful. And I want to put aside here the way decolonization actually looked like in South Africa. I realized from my South African friend that it has and still, a lot of challenges and a lot of things that may have not been done right. But this is there was a hopeful future in the sense that, there would be decolonization. It would not be a violent decolonization, right? I mean, I was just asking my colleague at the history department, that works on South Africa, how many whites, let's call it that way, Afrikaners were killed in anti-colonial, anti-apartheid violence in South Africa? And she said a tiny, 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 tiny number, right? She said, off the top of her head, maybe a few hundred. I don't commit me to that number, but in one day, obviously, we've seen number of Jews in Israel killed much larger than that. And so my point was that South Africa had this hope at the end of the way for something better, for that, settler colonialism ends in a certain way of peace and reconciliation, of a place that, the violence subsides, et cetera, et cetera. The track that we seem to be going in is the Algerian track with some caveats, right? In the Israeli case, you're not going to see a massive, departure of Jews and quote unquote return to the metropole, right? There is no metropole, right? But that country, right, even after the withdrawal of the, first of all, the civil war there was incredibly bloody with hundreds and thousands up to 1 million or more casualties. And then the withdrawal of the French had given the green light for a campaign of the killing of I think over tens of thousands of these Harakis, right? Those blamed of collaborating with the French regime. And then the country sank into another extended period of civil war, right? And so my fear is that we're going on that Algerian track, and that's a very, very sad prospect. And so, yeah, I'm, and there's also this, the cause of Palestine and the place of Palestine, Israel itself. Obviously, they run in the same circles, but it's not the same thing. And so while we see these, changes and encouraging changes in the way the cause is being discussed around the world, right? This unbelievable mobilization around the world, is in the US and elsewhere, against that plausible genocide that is going on in Gaza. The place itself is literally descending day by day, right? The carnage continued, the bloodbath, the sort of removal of more and more of any hope, really, for a future that is less violent. And so that's why I say that my thinking has changed, but it is really too early. We are really in the thick of this to really evaluate what influence this will have going forward.
There's just one or two more things I wanted to cover. So your book really focuses on, like I said, that non-elite versus elite dynamic. And also, I think it can give us insight into how institutions can generate identities. And what I'm getting at is, I think that your book is invaluable in helping us to understand the ways in which propaganda can affect
our lives and the way we perceive a conflict like Israel-Palestine. Can you talk about just the issue of propaganda in relation to this conflict?
Absolutely. You know, about a year ago, I got into this public debate on the pages of Israel's sort of most popular tabloid, Yedioth Ahronot, with this prominent columnist by the name of Ben-Dor Yamini. He's considered a centrist, whatever that means in the Israeli context. And like many in the security establishment, he sort of advocated the continuing of Israeli occupation, what many human rights organizations deem apartheid, including the siege of Gaza. And he echoed this Israeli slogan debate that another sort of propaganda slogan that dates back to the 50s, known in Hebrew as Ein Brera, or there's no alternative, right? That Israel does not wish to inflict this evil on Palestinians, but is forced to do so because of the nature of their opponent. Now, the reason I got into this uncivil exchange with Yamini was this article I published where I discussed my finding of this decade-long research that was preceded Dear Palestine. And I said, you know, after reviewing hundreds of sources in Arabic, I concluded that the most common Israeli claim in 1948 and for decades later of an Arab intention to quote unquote push Jews into the sea.
I wanted to ask you about this. I'm glad that you brought it up.
Likely not appear in Arab or Palestinian wartime propaganda. And the reason Yamini was upset is because a comment I added to this article I wrote, where he described as shameful and morally corrupt his decision to start his vastly popular weekly column with a quote-unquote reminder that like in 48, today as well, Palestinians seek to throw the Jews into the sea and exterminate them. Now, in the tail end of our uncivil exchange on all sorts of newspaper and online magazine, I wrote that Yamini's fabrication of history is more dangerous than many other fabrication because it will make Israeli Jews sort of entrenched in their choice of a regime of Jewish superiority under the assumption that Curtin II has genocide in store. Now, following the apocalyptic Hamas attack of October 7, right, the killing of 1,200 Israelis at close range and dozens of pogroms, including instances of rape and mutilation, there are few among Israeli Jews who dispute this axiom that extermination of epic proportion reminiscent of the Holocaust is around the corner. If not today, then tomorrow, if not Hamas and Hezbollah or Iran or all of them together. And therefore, what you see now is this public sentiment today that only a response in kind in Gaza, which many honestly admit will include and already includes massive ethnic cleansing, perhaps reaching that degree of genocide, is the only way to restore this national honor. So you see where a piece of propaganda that was crafted already in 48 really survived in unbelievable way through the decades and is really, you know, has a grip in some major ways on Israeli society. And that is not to say, you know, that the October 7 attacks, right, they're brutal and the kind of thing that we've talked about, right? I want to put that separately, whether or not this means that a larger kind of extermination is being sort of conceived and talked about. And that's, by the way, not the only piece of such propaganda that really held through the decades. What I show,
I was going to say real quick, isn't another one that I think it comes up in your book, if I recall correctly, is the line about Amalek.
Absolutely. And you know, the comparison of the Palestinians and other Arabs to Amalek and the seven nations of Canaan, right, that the Hebrew Bible calls to exterminate, it appears first in 1948. And you have IDF education materials to soldiers that are really echoing that message, right, including, shockingly, one of the most famous education officers of the Givati Brigade, his name is Abba Kovner, that is literally saying, throw the Egyptians into this ocean or into the Nile and slaughter them. He uses that kind of language. Now, what happens in 1948 is that kind of lurid propaganda, including the comparison to the seven nations of Canaan, etc., is actually, there is some significant dissent around it. One of the things I show is this meeting between education officers and the IDF, headed by the sort of chief education officer of the army, where some education officers are vehemently opposed to the use of that kind of vilification. And in fact, you see propaganda that was authored by Haredi or ultra-Orthodox figures for ultra-Orthodox soldiers in 48 that overwhelmingly disputes and writes against that kind of writing, saying that it is literally un-Jewish. And, you know, we can talk more about, you know, the place of this idea of seven nations of Canaan and Amalek in Jewish tradition. But I would say just briefly that for hundreds and hundreds of years, these ideas were never brought up. And this idea that those nations could be reincarnated in people that live in modern period was almost unheard of. Now, what you see is that there is dissent in 48 against this idea and certainly a rejection of that by some, but it certainly gains some hold. However, today, right, this is one of the most common ways to refer to Palestinians, right? I would argue, and that would be for our next conversation, that the entrenchment of religious and messianic Zionism in the Israeli political system in the last few decades have really brought to the fore that kind of rhetoric and that kind of language, right? And it's a very, very, very dangerous prospect that we see in the recent period, I think, much, much more vigorously.
If you have a few more minutes, there was just one or two more things here. In regards to 1948, can you talk about maybe how, you know, North American Jews that came over during 48 maybe came into conflict with, you know, the Yeshuv or Jews living in Palestine before the Zionist immigration wave of 1882? Because it seems like some of those North American Jews maybe had anti-militaristic attitudes, according to your book, and maybe they came in conflict at times with the strategies that others had in this conflict.
Yeah, and that's actually a really, really interesting development. So, you know, one of the main claims of the Zionist movement is that it's returning, right, the Jews to history, that for two millennia after, you know, the Israelites are expelled from the land of Israel, Jews have basically lost their place in history. And that only, you know, the Zionist movement, the establishment of a sovereign Jewish entity in Palestine, and a crucial part of that, an armed Jewish military force that can stand up to its right, only that could, quote unquote, return Jews to history. And when they say history, the idea is Western history. Now, not only that anti-militaristics and some pacifist ideas were circulating among American Jews in late 19th and early 20th century. Of course, that the notion that the Zionist movement, that the Jews were outside of history before Zionism had come, was vehemently rejected by American Jewish leaders since the onset of Zionism and into the 20th century. But more, what's more interesting is that the kind of, you know, even for those American Jews who had sympathized with Zionism, many have been gravitating more to the stream that I would today refer to as humanistic Zionism, right? And it's important to know that in the late 19th century, you know, there were these vigorous debates between Zionist intellectuals and leaders, etc. What form should Zionism take? Should it be a nation like all nations, kechol ha-goim, and, you know, imitate the kind of violent chauvinistic nationalism that was so common at the time and also celebrate the use of force? Or, on the other hand, be what is often referred to as a verse from Isaiah, a light unto nation, right? That's an idea often associated with Ahad Ha'am, who is this very prominent Zionist thinker. The idea was that this new idea of Jewish nationalism should build on the idea of Jewish morality and the universal message of Judaism to the world. Now, historians certainly argue whether this kind of humanistic Zionism was feasible in the context of settler colonialism, etc. And there's good arguments to be made on both sides, but in any case, you know, that those sort of competing ideas are in tension up to 1948. And some of the things that I show is that some of the letters really echo these arguments. Now, in the context of American Judaism, even those who had sympathized with Zionism and even those who had come to fight in 1948, this idea was that, certainly this version of humanistic Zionism should triumph. And I mentioned earlier, some of the letters that they send back home. But another example is not just that the letters that they themselves write, but kind of the letters that are written about them. And I want to give you just this very, very, very short quote by a Sabra Jew, that is a Jewish soldier that was born in Palestine or the land of Israel, to parents that immigrated from Eastern Europe. And she is reflecting on what she thinks are these American Jews and the way that they conduct themselves. Let me find that. I have it here. Hold on. Okay, so this is this female soldier. Her name was Tikva Honig Parnas. She later became a peace activist, but at the time she was very much sort of within this Zionist narrative. And this is what she writes to her parents about these two American volunteers that she encounters. She writes, "Nice fellows, but yesterday, when they saw all the Arabs, the women and children returning to their villages, starving for bread, they became, quote unquote, soft-hearted and had pity on them. And in the evening, they began to shout that if the Jewish state lacked the means to take responsibility for the economy of the territories it had occupied, it should never have gotten involved in the war. And that there is no reason just to kill Arabs without any justification." And responding to those volunteers' protest, she writes to her parents, "This America, with its idealistic Zionists, gets on one's nerves sometimes. Their entire philanthropic approach toward life and the world is also expressed in their attitude to Zionism."
And
And
that's
that would,
very interesting because that mirrors a lot of debates that I'm seeing today.
right. So it really does echo some of those changes. And these were certainly dissenting voice in 48. We are seeing today, I think, a significant change. Obviously, it's too early to call how significant, as a result of October 7, the Israeli desire to decimate really the Gaza Strip, what we're seeing in those days.
Yeah, it really does reflect that there are, it's just interesting because there were debates in the Jewish community back then, and there are debates now. I think that's very interesting. Before closing out, I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if you're resistant to this idea, but I would say you wouldn't place it in this context. I don't think you consider Dear Palestine to be necessarily within the canon of, the new historians' approach. So figures like Benny Morris or Ilan Pappe, but I do think there are overlaps with some of the work the new historians did. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. So, first of all, let's first tackle what is quote unquote new in the new historians, right? Palestinians and Arab authors from 1949 onwards were saying, we were displaced, forcibly expelled from this country by the Zionist movement in the State of Israel. But it's also important to note that those kind of voices that were written and even in the English language did not make much headway in sort of in the West, right? In French and English speaking places. And what the new historians have done is use sources from the Israeli archives to tell essentially that narrative, right? To show that 1948 was also had this massive process of ethnic cleansing that accompanied the war, the erasure of Arab Palestine. In that sense, my book is it has a lot of parallel with that because I do also use these unknown sources. Many of them are from the Israeli archives, although by no means all of them. However, the new historians mostly are interested in diplomatic and military history, and I cannot for the life of me tell you how bored I am from that kind of history. I mean, not bored, of course. I had to read much of it for this book, but I was really interested in the individual, right? In ordinary men and women, and what sense they made, sorry, of the reality that they endured, right? A lot of the kind of writing style and the themes and the questions that I ask are influenced by these project of oral testimonies of Palestinians from the Nakba, who were being collected in the late 70s and the 80s. You know, those are obviously our interviews that, you know, are made in a certain moment in time, and they tell something about the past, but they also tell about the moment in which they were recorded. I was really going for the gut reaction of people in what we would call real time. That's what I wanted to know. And you know, because in the Israeli context, you often hear that this work of groups like Breaking the Silence, right? This is a group of Israeli veteran soldiers who are telling about their experience of the occupation. And obviously, it has a long history, right, with groups like B'Tselem and others in Israel. So when people talk about them, they often argue, oh, that's a part of the zeitgeist, right? This is the German word for the spirit of the time, meaning at a certain point in the 80s and 90s, it became quote unquote fashionable to talk from this morally principled position against the evils done to others. But those letters that I was able to locate, right, and all the sources are sources that were written in real time, right? I don't use any retrospective sources. They actually tell that that kind of moral conundrum and those moral questions were really apparent already in real time among Jews, among Palestinians, among other Arab volunteers. And that's really what drew me to this project. So it certainly has some obvious parallels with those new historians, but the kind of stories that I tell, I would suggest, are somewhat actually quite different from what they were telling. And you know, some of them are you know, obviously did amazing, important work in telling a different story, not just on 48, but on Israeli history more broadly.
So I wanted to ask you, Shai, maybe you could talk a little bit about the settler movement in Israel today. I mean, there's a lot of news about it in the West Bank. Just they're doing a lot of damage. So how important do you think it is that the settler movement be examined right now?
I think they're the strongest political force in Israel. In fact, they have a hold on the Israel, not just the political system, but also the armed forces, the intelligence community, etc. You know, it's interesting because they're only 15% of the Jewish population, right? And when you look at early Zionism, right, most of the religious Orthodox figures in Eastern Europe objected to Zionism as a form of what they call false messianism, right? The idea that Jews would return to the land of Israel before the coming of the Messiah. But after 1967, right, they had obviously become much, 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 much more powerful and for decades. But then after 2005 and the decision of Israel to pull out its settlements from the Gaza Strip, their leaders, the rabbinic and other leaders, have made a strategic decision to take over or take a hold over the Israeli, not just the political system that is literally controlled by religious Zionists or the settler movement or messianic Zionism, but largely of the armed forces. And so, you know, the chief of staff and the head of the Shin Bet today in Israel, they are still from the old labor movement's elites. But under them, right, the entire upper brass of the IDF and the Shin Bet, the deputies, etc., are all coming from those circles, right? And they see, right, the apocalypse of October 7 is a true opportunity, the kind of which we have not, for them, seen since 1967, right? That is the opportunity to fundamentally reshape all of Israel-Palestine, right? So a form of ethnic cleansing in the Gaza Strip, but the far more important West Bank, right? Where several thousand Palestinians have been displaced since October 7, right? That is the ultimate goal. And more than that, I think that their hold on the Israeli political system and the Israeli state more broadly means that it will become very challenging, if not impossible, to go another route, right? At this historical juncture and certainly earlier historical juncture, to choose another curtain, one that is less violent, that means equality between everyone from the river to the sea. That's sadly not where we're going right now.
Do you think that that also, I mean, when it comes to the settler movement and also just, I would say that the sort of more messianic elements in Israeli society, this affects Palestinians, obviously. It affects Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. But I think it also could be very bad for, you know, more liberal Israelis. You know, I've spoken to Dalia Shindlin about this and others who have said, you know, it's almost like there's a fight for the soul of Israel over, you know, it's the state of Israel versus the state of Judea is the thing I often hear. Do you think these settler movement and the sort of messianic elements of Israeli society also pose a threat to Israelis?
Absolutely. I think it would definitely seem that the messianic elements are winning the day. It's too early to call the battle formally. But, you know, not just, you know, the, for example, Kahanism, right? Rabbi Meir Kahana, an American Jew, had immigrated to Israel in the 70s and launched a semi-successful movement and then was later assassinated in the U.S. He had left this very violent, very fascist, right, heritage that is gaining momentum of the kind that I never believed that I would see. And you know, it's really staying on the kind of really, of all sorts of Jewish heritages that were accepting of others and of liberal Judaism and certainly of liberal Israelis. But, you know, that's what we're seeing now. And I would certainly connect that with the larger trends of religious Zionism in Israel and their really ability to shape, you know, the public view in a certain way. And they're also the ones behind right now. Everyone everywhere is talking about Palestinians as Amalek and the seven nations of Canaan. That's their contribution, you know, of course, a shameful, regrettable contribution.
I've kept you over an hour here, but I just wanted to get one more thing in here. And it's not necessarily related to this specific book that you've written, but more so about, you know, the history of Israel-Palestine and a lot of the bad history that's been written. To this day, I've done a lot of episodes on Israel-Palestine, even before October 7th. And sometimes I will get angry emails saying, oh, you should read Joan Peters from Time Immemorial, then you will know the truth. And I, you know, I've looked at Joan Peters' book, and it's bad history. So can you comment on just the issue of badly written history or, you know, books like From Time Immemorial that, regardless of how much they've been debunked, somehow maintain some traction or still get brought up?
Absolutely.
And do you think they do damage?
First of all, not just From Time Immemorial, but also Exodus by Ian Uris, right? Which, of course, was one of the most popular books when it came out. And actually, I really want to thank you for that question, because that really relates to my new research project that looks at some of how those narratives gain hold and how enduring is that hold. And so what I'm about to show, and I've written a little bit about this in the past, is that, you know, Ben-Gurion himself in the late 50s was really concerned that the Israeli narrative that the Palestinians left of their own free will, you know, under the command of their leaders, that kind of narrative is being weakened in Western countries. And he actually commissioned three different studies by professional historians that would supposedly prove that these Palestinians left of their free will. And this was a serious international endeavor that he led until his death in the 1960s. And so, you know, these narratives, right? And, you know, Uris's book Exodus was written with help by Israeli officials. And it's not the only project. There are some others like that. And so those celebratory narratives I think have gained a major hold, certainly. But that's the kind, that's a very common thing. And so we have that on the U.S. Civil War, and some scholars in the U.S. context show us that, look at soldiers' letters from the Civil War. How many are writing actually about slavery? Is that really what and there's another book by I forgot the author's name on World War II. How many of the U.S. soldiers were fighting to defeat Hitler? How much is that on their agenda? And so, making history messier is really, I think, the work of historians. And if you have this neat history that also happens to lead to support and buttress a national project, especially one that is violent, that's the moment that we should be really wary about that and seek to bring it down slowly.
It also just popped in my head. I promise to let you go, but do you think the situation with the archives will ever change? Because I, talking to Alain Poppe and people like yourself, it seems like there's been a lot of problems getting access to these archives. Do you think that situation will ever go in the other direction where, historians will have more access?
So that's one of my sort of favorite pastime activities is to fight for declassification. And you mentioned that I even went to the Supreme Court over this. Look, Israel is rapidly changing, right? Fascist and other tendencies are gaining momentum, and so it's very hard for me to predict what the future holds. But let's say something about the moment that we're in, and when I include the moment, I mean even a few decades earlier, right? Israel proclaims to be a liberal democracy, and I think that until recently it was one for Jews, only for Jews, and whether that qualifies as an actual democracy is a different debate. But as long as it did and made those claims, it could not basically basically say, oh, we are banning all access to archival material. And in fact, the Israeli archival law, based on a 1955 German law, is a very, very liberal law. The question of how it gets implemented, and those that are in charge of declassification in Israel are often these ex-intelligence officials that are very concerned that narratives such as the one that the New Historians tell, such as the one that I hope the Palestine tells, will get disseminated, right? And so they're working to censor and redact sources from being able to tell these differing narratives. However, as long as Israel continues making the argument, right, that it is adhering to liberal democracy's tendencies, it will not be able to sanitize and redact its archive, right? The Nakba, the Mizrahi-Ashkenazi divide, Israeli occupation literally screams at you from almost every page of every document of the many, many millions in the archives, right? A lot of it has been closed, much in 1948, and I've certainly had many legal challenges and struggles to get those documents, for the last 10 decade. However, there is still a lot there. What the future holds, what the tendencies of the Israeli society and government, where they're going, is very, very hard to predict. It can really go either way, either massive closure or, the understanding that, these stories and narratives about the past is something that are worth unearthing and telling, because who are they hiding it from? They're hiding it from the Israeli Jewish public, right? It's not that they're hiding it from some like the Palestinians or the world more broadly. That's who they're hiding it from. And so I can only hope that that would change.
Well, hey, I want to thank you, Shai Hasnani, for coming on Parallax Views. I hope people will check out your book, Dear Palestine. It's been out for a few years now, and it's a really valuable book, in my opinion. I'm still reading it and going over it and trying to go more in depth with it, but I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. What do you want listeners to get out of this conversation, and what are your parting words, especially now with everything we see unfolding?
Well, I'm gonna make a leap of imagine or assuming that most of the listeners are based here in North America, for the podcast, although I'm sure many listen from elsewhere, right? it's really crucial that people know that this and everything that's going on in Palestine, Israel, is a co-production, right? It's not just certainly Israel or the forces around it, right, et cetera, from Hamas to Hezbollah to Arab states. The US, it's not just playing a crucial role. It is really probably one of the most essential parties to enabling everything that we're seeing there. So if you're on board with what we're seeing there, well, then we disagree, and you will probably find other kind of podcasts and books. But if you're not in agreement with that, then that needs to be fought against, right? And the kind of shameful responses that we see from our Democrat elected leaders and others, that can be changed. They can be held accountable, and they can do their fair share, which is a very fair share of imagining a less violent future in Palestine, Israel.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Shai Hasrani, and that you'll consider checking out both his book, Dear Palestine, A Social History of the 1948 War, and his documentary, The Soldier's Opinion. As always, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, that makes this show possible. I only have one advertiser, the mighty Mike Swanson of Wall Street Window, but otherwise, this show is entirely listener-supported. So please head on over to patreon.com/parallaxviews and kick me some much needed cash if you can afford it. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.